This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Friday, 27th of August, 2021. And with this latest terror attack in Kabul, as the ongoing airlift is continuing, apparently by Islamic State or some other terrorist outfit. There were warnings all around, both from the Taliban and the U.S. and other allied forces, that there was a high risk of terror. I don't know how they pick up this noise, but it happened and it's terrible. And obviously, I think there was, I saw an estimate coming in here, something like 100 people dead. I think it did affect risk appetite at the margin, at least in terms of market effects yesterday. Some of that was erased overnight, but still a bit of nervousness there. And I think a part of that is justified because if we just recall, there had not been a single serviceman lost in the or woman lost in the by the U.S. forces in Afghanistan for the last 18 months. So suddenly we have 13 killed in a terror attack here when they're trying to do a humanitarian operation. It's pretty ugly stuff. And of course, the knock-on effects could be there, but the market is just not, it's really hard to price this into market. So I want to separate the terrible situation and the casualties on the ground from market effects here. There was a bit of a message out overnight in China on the PBOC talking about easing the triple R for banks and the spin on that, or the positioning of that move being that it was hoping to spark rural lending. So there's a lot of this focus on that inequality issue and supporting the lower part of the K, if you will, as of course, a lot of this focus on the recent regulatory crackdown has been on the big platforms that are collecting information. The Chinese state clearly wants to have a monopoly on that front. So Peter, with that absurdly long lead in, and actually just finally, I want to mention the S&P did come off yesterday, of course, snap back a little bit overnight. We have a bit of a triple divergence on the technicals if this rally fades here. It would have to fade, I think, another 50 points or so. Interesting to see what happens here ahead of the Powell speech. We'll talk more on that later. But what are you seeing as you're coming in this morning, Peter, in equity markets?
Well, it's a little bit, unfortunately, the same story as yesterday. We have some quiet markets ahead of this Jackson Hole event. So I don't expect massive fireworks before we get any headlines out of the Jackson Hole event. That is sort of the next big thing. And we talked about it in our internal call, John. I mean, it's just, you have these inflation signs everywhere, right? You know, they have Toyota saying the semiconductor will be constrained till the end of 2022. So we still have a lot of supply side risk. COVID-19 now talk about a new mutation. So it's there's a lot of things going on. And we, at the same time, we have import prices year and year in Germany spiking to the highest level since early 1980s. And news coming out that Germans are hoarding physical gold bars because they're afraid of inflation. So transitory or not, you know, the real action on the ground is that we have a lot of difficulties, and with a U.S. Government being eager to stimulate on the demand side of things, let's see where this where it takes us. There's not much to add on the theme baskets, John. So except maybe the bubble stocks were sort of leading the declines together with crypto yesterday. But I'll quickly jump to the Peloton news, because that was the single biggest news after the US market close. So Peloton, we highlighted yesterday in our earnings watch. You laughed because they're selling this, you know, these exercise treadmills, and they're doing all sorts of different partnerships. They even want to do a partnership with Facebook, with Oculus, creating a digital experience around physical exercising. They were down 6% after the market closed. They had a disappointing outlook, $800 million for the current quarter they're in revenue versus $1 billion expected. They're cutting their original bikes by $400. They are moving to a printing model, selling a hardware with a small growth margin on top of it, and then sell subscriptions, which they have 2.3 million off, which is very stable revenue. They do expect an operating loss for the current fiscal year, which will end in end of 30th of June next year. So this is still a story that is evolving. And then there was some talk about some internal weakness on their accounting side. So we just mentioned Peloton because it's a huge popular stock among retail investors. And I think a lot of what happened yesterday was very much inconclusive. So I suspect Peloton to remain in a trading range.
All right. And then I'll say on a bit interesting to see, not much of a risk off move. It was very modest, wasn't it, yesterday on this this news and ahead of Powell. It does feel like markets are a bit nervous, but they're really a bit complacent as well, not really expecting much from Jackson Hole. What's your take on the Treasury market and especially the second slide you have today about this very short-term, these short-term bills and some things you're seeing there?
Yes, John, just starting off on the longer part of the yield curve. Yesterday, we had quite a successful seven-year auction. And this is quite important to acknowledge before the Jackson Hole, because it means that U.S. Treasury U.S. Treasuries remains well beat, because the 7 years is one of the least liked maturities. Before the auction, we have seen 10-year yields, yields across the curve rising. But it was very interesting what the 10-year yields did, because they rose to try the resistance level at 1.37%. And that was amid some hawkish remarks from three oaks of the Federal Reserve, Kaplan, Bullard and George. U.S. Treasury yields failed to break above this level. However, it looks like that if they break this level today, amid the PCE numbers later at 2:30 and the Powell speech, it's quite, they could rise easily to try next resistance at 1.42%. I just want to remind everybody that the year-to-date monthly standard deviation for 10 years U.S. Treasury yields is around 6 basis points. So it's quite normal to see yields shifting higher or lower 6 basis points. In times of exceptional volatility, we can see them rises double as that. At the end of February, when there was the reflation trade, we have seen in one single day U.S. Treasury yields rising 15 basis points. So definitely, these are very important levels, and it's worthwhile to watch them during today as things evolve.
Yeah.
John,
Yeah, go ahead. No, I think you're going to lead into it anyway. On the next slide, you're talking about these shorter-term bills. And we're maybe getting ahead of ourselves, but it is such an important thing to discuss, as we talked about earlier this week, this sort of boomerang effect once we get to the other side of the debt ceiling issue and this, as Treasury issuance rises.
Yeah, John, the comments I'm going to make now really connect with what we have said earlier this week. Basically, the money market are starting to fret about the debt ceiling, and the later a debt ceiling decision is going to be taken, the more volatility we will start to have, because the U.S. Treasuries, once that we arrive at the beginning of November, will need to issue at least $500 billion in bond issuances in order to refinance existing debt. So basically what's happening in the money market, John, is that T-bills are starting to price that risk. And on slide number 5, you see the spread between 4 and 8 weeks. This was since May until now. And as you can see, basically, it has risen to 2.5 basis points. Just last week, that same spread was 1.5 basis points. But more interesting is that the 8-week T-bills priced at 6 basis points, which is 1 basis point above the Federal Reserve RRP rate. So definitely something is happening there, and we could expect maturities falling at the end of October and beginning of November to start to widen as we get closer to that and a decision about the debt ceiling is not reached.
Yeah, we'll have to watch how the politics shape up coming into those key deadlines. As far as the FX market, we are still poised on a fulcrum, poised at a balancing point on these trends. We've kind of reversed a lot of the dollar pair movements to the upside, but we haven't, not sufficiently so to argue that we've seen a critical reversal just yet. So we need to see the reaction on the back of this Jackson Hole meeting. Somewhat similar for the Japanese yen, although the reversal has been a bit sharper there because, as you can see on slide six, the dollar yen has sort of crept back up towards 110. You can see there's a whole cluster of sort of highs right around that 110 level and slightly higher. This so-called Ichimoku cloud has come into view here around the same level. So also very pivotal there. And we have to watch especially the long end of the US yield curve in the wake of Jackson Hole to see if there's any reactivity. And if yields do head higher, we would expect to see potential for a break higher. But we've just been triangulating here for a couple of months. And it was kind of similar to an episode we saw back late last year and into January before US yields engineered a significant break of the range higher. So I would argue we'd have to see a significant break lower to get dollar yen back severely on the defensive, as opposed to just drifting lower, which would be the case potentially if yields are not going anywhere and we're seeing a weaker dollar. And then elsewhere, it's all about the sort of the pro-cyclical currencies and whether we're going to see a renewal of this commodity trade. But Peter, let's get back to an issue we were talking about at the outset of the week, and actually late last week when markets were very much more on the defensive. And I penned a piece looking at the risk and some bits and pieces of evidence of the risk of a significant market drawdown. You brought in a slide also earlier this week, if I'm not mistaken, it was the day before yesterday, on this being one of the longest periods we've seen without a significant drawdown for global markets, leading to potentially over-leveraging and overconfidence and complacency. So it's always the question becomes, well, yeah, I don't want to just go into cash. I need to have some sort of hedging of my existing positions rather than simply reducing, although reducing can be a key part of any risk reduction. But you've had this idea before, and you've put some more thought into this approach to a novel approach, you would argue, to tail hedging. So take us through that.
You're absolutely right, John. We talked about it. We're continuing very low downside volatility in markets. So you wonder when we get the hiccup in equities. And you're right. We've talked about how do you hedge. And I've had a couple of client requests lately. So I thought, okay, if there's a bunch of clients talking about how you hedge your portfolio in a cost-effective way, maybe there are other clients that are, you know, thinking about the same issues. And the classical approach is to buy put options. As AQR have shown in a paper back in 2012, it becomes pretty expensive over time, and you're getting these big rewards, but then you bleed and you have a negative expected return on that insurance, a negative carry, as we call it. They argue that you should use trend following strategies to do the tail hedging. That can be done with some success, but it's not really manageable, I think, for an ordinary private retail investor. It's just not doable to do these trend following strategies. So that's up for professional investors if you want to do that. And I'm not even sure it's the best way. Then you can it has been shown that if you do a little bit more active management around put options, you can actually get much better performance. That's from Newfound Research. Again, I don't think it's very feasible for retail investors to actively be managing a put option strategy. Then the third option, which is the one we use in the 100-year portfolio by our CIO, Steve Jacobson, we use a long volatility strategy where you long VIX futures, which is sort of on the middle of the curve. The idea being that when equities and everything else fall out of bed, the VIX index gallops higher, and then you win on your long VIX position, and then you're better off. But that also, because of the curvature of the VIX futures curve, you have a negative carry as well, a negative expected return. So long introduction, but then we're coming to the tail hedging with market makers. So there are two pure play market makers that are publicly listed in the world, and that's Flow Traders on the Amsterdam Exchange, which got famous for being the biggest one in ETF market making here in Europe. And they're branching out into all sorts of other instruments and gear and geographies. And in the US, we have Virtual Financial, which has become one of the largest market makers across the globe, across all exchanges, all instruments. You have it, even crypto now, I think. So if you take these two markets, so market makers, when you have a lot of volatility across asset, you know, the bid offer spreads widens, they get paid for providing the much needed liquidity to make markets work. And that means that they have some extraordinary, you know, characteristics. They go up whenever everyone else bleed. I looked at the correlation between flow traders and Virtue to the MSCI world over this period from May 2016 until July this year. And that correlation is minus 0.18, which is extraordinary, because in the old days you could hedge your portfolio, Johns, with bonds, and with the very low interest rate we've had for 10 years, that hedging capability have been removed. So we have to look at something else. And before I start my spiel, the good thing about the market makers is that they enjoy a positive expected return over the long run, because nominal or gross volume in the financial markets go up over time with nominal GDP because of financialization. And that means that there's an underlying, you know, improvement in operating income for market makers over time. And then when and then when we had the volatility, you get the extra icing on the cake.
Interesting, very interesting approach. And it looks like, or it'll be very interesting to see if we do get a drawdown, if that pattern repeats. And certainly a novel approach to hedging a portion of your tail risk. And then on the earnings front, getting quiet and getting into Friday here, I suppose there's not much to focus on now that we're free of the Asian session and heading for, I guess, a quieter period of earnings season in coming weeks.
Yeah, there are two names that we focus on today. Trip.com, which is the big, it's the Expedia of China, 45,000 employees, a big travel company. They have been constrained a lot by the strict policies on the pandemic in China. They typically don't provide too much color and information to shareholders. So it's not that an interesting company. But BYD is interesting, not the least because Berkshire Hathaway is one of the major shareholders and have been investing in it for 13 years. And classic, sorry to say, the media say they always use the Warren Buffett, but it was not Warren Buffett that did the BYD deal. That was Charlie Munger. He was impressed by the founder of BYD. He's a chemist in China, and they've been investing for 13 years. And as you can see in the share price here on slide 8, it has done very well over the past couple of years, especially since the lows from the pandemic. They have a very successful strategy on electric vehicles. They use a different type of batteries, which are much easier to produce and cost less, because it's not a lithium iron battery. So they are very suitable for smaller electrical vehicles that can be used in dense urban areas in China. And that strategy has been extremely successful. So, so the question is basically, can they continue to deliver? Because I think they need to deliver very concrete numbers here to justify the rally, which, you know, has set the stock price up by, I think, sixfold in 18 months.
All right. We'll watch for that. And we'll watch for some key things coming up today, to say the least. I'm glad we're going to be on the other side of talking about this speech after today. We have Fed Chair Powell out speaking at the virtual Jackson Hole Symposium. I'm sure it's a bit of a shame that it's virtual. It's supposed to be one of the most beautiful places in the U.S., Jackson Hole, Wyoming. But what are we looking for here? I think the complaints or the sort of expectations around this are a little bit off relative to what I'm expecting. I'm not expecting any very pointed or strong signals from the Fed, but I do think that there's sufficient discomfort with what they've seen on the inflation front, perhaps enough in the debate and enough richness in that debate on the part of some Fed individuals looking at whether this crisis and the approach of only supporting demand and not enough look at the supply side of the economy means that their tools are rather the wrong tools for addressing the situation. In other words, I think, and given that we've seen this massive growth in the Fed's reverse repo facility, means that they sort of got a buffer now of extra QE on hand that they can use down the road, even if they were to stop QE purchases tomorrow, which of course they're not going to do. So they have some 10 months of QE built up in that reverse repo facility, if you will. I think we're not going to get anything super specific on the timing here. It would be my suspicion, but we could get an indication maybe around the edges, between the lines, of this A, discomfort, and B, the implications of that being that they want to get rid of this QE as fast as possible so that they can have be in a nimble state and the ability to react with interest rate signaling down the road if that becomes necessary. So they've always said they want to get the QE taper down to zero first, the balance sheet growth tapered first. before discussing interest rates. So they want to get that out of the way is my message here. And I think we'll maybe get that message, might be a bit more hawkish at the margin than expected. There's also some chance that the signal is a bit weak and not really something the market is picking up on. Regardless, I think there's some people out there that might be looking to take a position in these markets and are simply waiting for this speech to get out of the way, to be out of the way first before putting capital at risk. And there's also that angle of things. And I think I've seen this in the past where it's not really the event itself necessarily that provides some very clear trigger to market action, but it's just now it's out of the way. We can get on with the agenda. And that agenda becomes a bit more pressing as well, since we're wrapping up the summer here in the coming couple of trading days. And once we get post Labor Day, sort of officially, that starts the traditional end of summer and into the fall season in the US. Two other things, we got the PCE inflation data point today. That's expected to come in a little bit lower on the month on month. I think it'll be unsettling if it doesn't. So expected for the July figure to come down to 0.4% on the headline and 0.3% at the core for month on month. If that is higher than expected, could add to the situation as well. And then the University of Michigan sentiment survey, a huge, huge, huge 11-point drop. I think there was only in modern memory one drop of that magnitude, and that was the month after the pandemic broke out. And is this the Delta variant? Most likely it is. But we'll want to see if there's any adjustment to that, especially on the inflation expectation side as we're heading into next week. And I've got all the numbers for next week as well on slide 9 in today's slide deck. And just recall that we have on Tuesday, whether we get some confirmation that in the Conference Board consumer confidence number, and if confidence is collapsing, to what degree are we going to see some of the numbers start to weaken in the U.S.? But the key numbers in focus next week include all the usual employment stuff. But I would highlight the ISM services on Friday. If people are losing confidence, how much is activity increasing? Are we seeing a deceleration risk on that front? So that's all in the mix. If there's something dramatic that comes out of the Jackson Hole conference, look out on Twitter. It's probably the easiest place to find the links. My account at John J. Hardy and the Saxo Market Call account at Saxo Market Call. We may pen a piece in the wake of that speech, if there is something that needs to be pointed out and that is triggering significant market action. So stay tuned for that. Stay careful out there. We're still a little bit nervous in these markets. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back next week with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.